Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar. Led by the Philadelphia-based Clean Air Council, a group of 61 petitioners is calling on state regulators to establish a cap-and-trade program in Pennsylvania to reduce carbon emissions that contribute to climate change. And a constitutional amendment that says Pennsylvanians have a right to clean air and water is the tool they're using to force the issue. Joining us to talk about this significant action today is John Dernbach, Commonwealth Professor of Law and Sustainability, Director of the Environmental Law and Sustainability Center at Widener University Commonwealth Law School. Professor Dernbach, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Scott. It's nice to be here.
Also, Marie Cusick, who has been reporting on these issues and energy, other energy issues here in Pennsylvania over the years as part of State Impact Pennsylvania. Marie, welcome to the show.
Great to be here, Scott.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or a comment on WITF's Facebook page, on Twitter. We are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. John Dernbach, you are one of, from what I understand, one of the authors of this petition that is being filed. What prompted this action?
Well, Scott, I think there were two kinds of things that prompted it. One is we're seeing a lot of impacts from climate change, and the impacts are growing year by year. And I think the second thing is with the recognition by the Pennsylvania Supreme Court of Article 1, Section 27, that every citizen in the state has a right to a decent environment. We saw that as an important way to frame this question. In other words, the resources that we all have a right to are resources that are seriously at risk with climate change, and we deeply feel that the state needs to take very significant action to address that.
So you kind of touched on this, but I want to find out, what exactly are you looking for?
The petition asks the Environmental Quality Board, which is the rulemaking authority for the state of Pennsylvania, the Department of Environmental Protection, to adopt what we're calling an auction cap-and-trade program for greenhouse gas emissions. And what that means in plain English is that it essentially puts a kind of a price on carbon. The price would grow on a regular basis between now and 2050, and the idea would be to use that price to drive a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions to zero by 2052.
Now, just to be clear, because Marie and I have had this conversation, just so I was clear on, and I want the audience to be clear as well, this is not filed as a court action. It's not a lawsuit, but it is filed with the Department of Environmental Protection, correct?
Yes, that's right. This is not litigation. This is the Environmental Quality Board is the rulemaking authority for the Department of Environmental Protection. When I was at the department, we did all sorts of rulemakings on all kinds of different issues: solid waste, water quality, air pollution control, and all the rest. And what happens is the department by itself does not have that rulemaking authority. The Environmental Quality Board has that authority. There's a provision in the Pennsylvania law that authorizes petitions to the EQB, the Environmental Quality Board, to adopt regulations, and it's pursuant to that that we filed the petition. And again, this is not a court action.
Murray, one thing, and Professor Dernbach explained this a little bit, but cap and trade, maybe explain how that works. Know that this petition, as you reported, has been modeled after California.
Yeah, at a basic level, a cap-and-trade system is a market-based system which sets a firm limit or a cap on overall emissions, and then it allows companies to buy and sell allowances to pollute certain amounts, and the cap reduces over time. And this is based on California's system. I'll also note we already have such a system in the Northeast. It's called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative, and it's a collaboration among 9 northeastern states. So this is already going on, and it was one of Governor Tom Wolf's campaign pledges in when he first ran in 2014 to join the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative known as REGGI. So it's a system that already exists elsewhere.
You said that Governor Wolf pledged to do that, but I seem to remember you reporting, has that happened?
No, it hasn't.
Okay. Go a little further.
I reported on this earlier this year. I did a story just talking to some environmental groups and looking at his sort of environmental record in his first term. And there's been a lot of frustration among environmental advocates and environmental groups with him because, you know, he says he takes climate change seriously and he believes it's real, but he really hasn't moved to aggressively address it. Now, of course, he would face, you know, opposition from the Republicans in the legislature if he were to try to do something. Clearly, they haven't shown an interest in addressing climate change either. But this mechanism, if the Wolf administration were to embrace it, could be a way to sort of largely circumvent the legislature.
And there's a lot there that we can talk about. Professor Dernbach, there will be pushback on this. First of all, there are those who don't see climate change caused by humans as real, or at least not caused by humans. Then you'll have people say that this is too expensive, it will cost industry, which will lead to fewer jobs. And of course, this goes way back beyond just what you're doing here with asking for a cap and trade program. This goes back to kind of the philosophical or the politics of climate change and who thinks it's happening and it's caused by humans. So you have to face those issues as well. As Marie just pointed out, you probably will get pushback in the Republican legislature. What about all those things?
Well, I think, yes, you're right. And those are issues that need to be addressed. On the science, what you see happening with the science is if you go back say to the 1990s and look at what the scientists were saying and look at the impacts that we were experiencing then. A lot of the impacts that we talked about in the 1990s or that scientists talked about in the 1990s were modeled impacts and were projected. And the impacts that people were experiencing were a little bit hard to discern. If you fast forward on the clock to the present time, we're no longer talking about impacts that are in a model somewhere. They're impacts that we're actually experiencing, and they're more and more severe all the time. And the science is clear all the time. I mean, I think the issue here, I think, on the science is that we've turned the science into an issue about yes versus no, and I think it's more helpful to think of the science in terms of what risk are you willing to bear. And if you're not certain that the science says what the scientists believe or that the science is correct, well, are you 100% sure that you're right? And if you're 100% sure that you're right, well, that's a kind of an unusual place to be because most of us aren't that sure about most things. But if there you see some risk out there, if there's some risk, you might be wrong. Then it's appropriate to think about what in prudence, what would a prudent person do? Now, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania has a constitutional obligation as trustee of the state's public natural resources to act with prudence. And what would a prudent manager do for those resources in the face of what a lot of the science is saying? And I'm thinking that a prudent manager would say, well, you know, this is something that we ought to address. The risks are serious. On the issue of cost, if I can just sort of you
sure.
address, I
Go
think
ahead.
About on the issue of cost, two things. One is just really big picture. You're seeing the cost of solar and wind energy falling pretty rapidly, like remarkably rapidly. The economic landscape today is not the same economic landscape that we had two decades ago, and it's not even the same landscape that we had last year or the year before. What investment firms are showing is that the levelized cost of electricity, if you look, and that's a code language or sort of a technical term for how much does electricity cost without a lot of subsidies and government intervention, what you're seeing is solar and wind are beating coal for sure and are beginning to beat gas over and over again. And so as prices fall, that's an important slice of reality. I mean, and the other thing I would say about cost in jobs, I mean, there's way more to say about this than you can do in a radio interview,
right,
but
right.
The other thing to say about cost in jobs is that there is abundant evidence where the energy jobs are growing right now, all across the country, and including in Pennsylvania, is with wind and solar and energy efficiency. That's where the jobs are. In my experience, working for almost 15 years at the Department of Environmental Resources, now the Department of Environmental Protection, is if you give the private sector some certainty about what the landscape is going to look like over the next several decades, which is precisely what this proposed regulation would do, sort of phasing, scaling up the cost of carbon over time. If you give the business community some reasonable expectation and certainty about what the environment, the economic environment is going to look like over several decades, they're going to do really, really well with it. And that's what we saw in the waste program. That's what we saw in recycling. That's what we saw with residual waste years ago when I was working on those programs.
Yeah, I just want to echo what Professor Dernbach said about risk. I think it's sort of wrong to frame or think about the climate change issue as, is it real or not? I mean, the science has been settled for quite a long time. I think the way to think about it really, even if you maybe personally have some doubts about it, it's about seizing opportunities and it's about mitigating risks. You know, any smart person wants to mitigate risks, and you don't want to build your house in a floodplain and you want to take advantage of new opportunities. So that's really where the rest of the world is on this issue. And in the United States, it is a political partisan discussion, but it's not in the rest of the world. I think that's important to understand.
Well, just to follow up on that, Marie, and yeah. Something that Professor Dernbach said, that when he said that we've made this into a yes-no conversation, that's just what you're talking about. But, you know, and I don't want to, my goal during this program is not to talk about whether climate change exists or not. I think we agree that the science is settled, but unfortunately, that's what the conversation, the big conversation, goes back to, is yes, no, is it happening, is it caused by humans?
Well, I think, as a member of the press, I've thought about this a lot, and I thought about how am I best serving the public by reporting on this? And I think actually saying, oh, so-and-so doesn't believe in climate change, or they're like name-calling and that sort of thing, it's just not effective or helpful. So the other thing I don't think people think about or talk about enough is the moral dimension of this, because often you hear like, well, you know, the United States has been lowering its emissions and look at China and India and what, why should we, you know, do anything because they're polluting a lot. Well, the West, the United States and Europe, we created a lot of this mess with our legacy emissions. You know, as we grew our economies and advanced, we created a lot of the problem, and it's our moral obligation to fix it. If people who don't have as many opportunities and money to adapt are getting flooded, and countries in the Pacific could even drown and just lose their entire country, I mean, it is our moral and ethical obligation to deal with this problem.
And I don't want to get too far off track with the petition, and we'll talk more about it in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest today, John Dernbach, Commonwealth Professor of Law and Sustainability at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, and Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania reporter. We're talking about a petition that has been filed that asks a state legislature, calls on state regulators, I should say, to establish a cap-and-trade program in Pennsylvania to reduce carbon emissions that contribute to climate change. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532, or send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Before we take some phone calls here, Professor Dernbach, one thing I want to ask, and you were talking about, you know, obviously we're talking about the planet, a global situation. What can a state, now Pennsylvania is the third leading emitter of greenhouse gases, what can a state do to, you know, when it takes action that would try to mitigate the problems caused by these emissions?
Yeah, I think the question you're asking is, what difference does it make at Pennsylvania?
In so many words, yeah.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania is responsible for maybe 1% of U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. If Pennsylvania were a country, it would be about the 21st largest emitter. I think the simple answer to that is that everybody's got to play a role, and that waiting for everyone else to move first is a recipe for disaster. What we saw years ago when I worked in the waste program years back in the 1980s, is Pennsylvania played a leadership role among a great many other states with its recycling and municipal waste programs. And that's part of the dimension in this, is as far as I'm concerned. We make our contribution. What a prudent trustee would do is that a prudent trustee would not wait for others to act. A prudent trustee would basically say, well, look, we can do something here, and we can make a contribution to solving this problem. And in doing that, we can play a leadership role and persuade other countries, other states to come along. And 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions is not a small thing. That slows, if what you can get rid of 1% of global greenhouse gas emissions over the next couple of decades, that's a significant contribution.
You're not going to get rid of them, but you'll reduce them.
Right. Well, you reduce them to zero, so you eventually get rid of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Let's take a phone call from Myrna in Upper Allen Township. Myrna, you're on the air.
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call.
Yes, you're welcome.
Dr. Dernbach, I wondered if you're aware that yesterday five members of the U.S. House of Representatives introduced the Energy Innovation and Carbon Dividend Act. It puts a price on carbon, reduces carbon emissions rapidly, and returns the fee to citizens. Do you think that the state would be the one to have a regulation, or do you prefer federal legislation? What can you talk about that?
All right. Thank you very much for your call, Myrna.
Yeah, thanks. That's a great question. The short answer, I think, to this is that doing this at the federal level is way better than doing it at the state level, if doing it at the federal level is possible. And that's the important qualification. The proposal yesterday is a pretty good proposal. The dividend approach, returning the money to the American public, that's a good thing too. And if that were adopted, that would go a long way toward addressing this issue. But in the absence of federal action, we're proposing what we're proposing.
Let's take another call from Michael in New Oxford along the same lines. Michael, you're on the air.
Yes, I would like to know, beyond the petition, why not a lawsuit against the federal agents, EPA, because we particularly know what Scott Pruitt has done to Oklahoma. I believe he's still under investigation under that aspect of it. But I think there's a clear violation of the Pennsylvania Constitution. And I would like to say that every voice, every individual, has a moral and ethical responsibility to speak out.
Okay, now, Michael, before you go, when you say a violation of Pennsylvania's Constitution, in what way? Meaning that it is violating Act 1, Section 27, that guarantees or gives the right for clean air and water. Okay. Thank you very much. Professor Dernbach, what about that?
Well, I think our approach to this is to give the Department of Environmental Protection and the Environmental Quality Board a chance to chew on this and to look at a specific proposal before we get to the point where we engage in litigation. At the federal level, there's quite a great deal of litigation that's going on against EPA for a variety of different things that it's done. And you can look at Article 1, Section 27 and say, well, Section 27 says that people have a right to clean air, pure water, and to the preservation of the natural, scenic, historic, and aesthetic values of the environment. Section 27 also assigns to the Commonwealth the responsibility for protecting, or actually for conserving and maintaining, public natural resources. And yes, you can argue that the state has not done what it should have done over the last number of years, and that it is still not doing what it should have done. But our view is that we wanted to give the state the opportunity to look at a specific proposal, to seriously consider a proposal that is that has been drafted in quite some detail before we think about litigation.
Marie, you have reported extensively recently, especially on Act 1, Section 27. In fact, you produced a television show just recently about it. For decades, this amendment didn't get much attention. I mean, it's been around since the late 60s, but it is now. Why?
Yeah, Article 1, Section 27, the Environmental Rights Amendment. In fact, Professor Dernbach's research actually contributed quite a bit to the amendment's resurgence. But it really was just interpreted by the courts in a way that made it sort of toothless. And there were two recent cases dealing with Marcellus Shale gas drilling where the State Supreme Court of Pennsylvania upheld a broad interpretation of it. So really, the legal landscape around this amendment is starting to shift. And, you know, Professor Dernbach brought up the trustee aspect, which is that the Commonwealth is required to act as a trustee of the public natural resources for all people. And it says, including generations yet to come. And the way to sort of think about that is like a fiduciary. So you may be familiar with this and like your personal financial advisor, you want that person to be required. That person should be required to think about and act in your best interest. And so, you know, thinking about it in sort of monetary sense, these natural resources are a valuable economic resource, and we all rely on them. It's not just a nice thing to have. So the state is required under the state constitution to act with prudence. And that Professor Dernbach and the other petitioners are arguing that because of that constitutional responsibility, the state has the requirement to
act
to deal with climate change.
So, Professor, duty, you know, I'm, as Marie is explaining this, I'm thinking to myself, okay, does the state make the first move in order to comply with Act 1, Section 27, or does it take a petition like yours or other court action, legal action, to force the state to do that?
Well, as I said, I think the plan that we had is to give the state, and maybe I'm not understanding your question, but I think our plan was to give the state to provide a particular specific proposal to the state. And one of the things that I want to be really clear about is that this has not yet been done in Pennsylvania. Until this petition was filed, this had not yet been done. No one had put in front of the Department of Environmental Protection or any other decision maker in Pennsylvania a proposal this specific, this Pennsylvania specific, this detailed to actually address this issue. And what we're trying to do is to give decision makers the opportunity to picture what this would look like, so that we're not talking about this at 30,000 feet, some abstract level about shall we act or not. The shall we adopt this specific proposal? And our argument is, and I think Marie and I have been sort of trying to say this, is that the state has a constitutional duty to conserve and maintain public natural resources. Those resources are at risk with climate change. They're already being adversely affected. They include air quality and water quality and the forests of the state, the availability of water for drinking and other purposes. I mean, what the data shows and what the Penn State researchers have concluded is that the temperatures in Pennsylvania could be as high as 5 degrees Fahrenheit higher on average than they are now by the year 2050. And that doesn't mean they're going to stop rising at 2050. They keep going. And so I think our thought process is that what a prudent trustee would do in the face of this, in all the costs that that's going to bring to the private industry, to farmers, to municipalities trying to figure out their water supply, and to average everyday citizens in their lives disrupted by extreme weather events like flooding and 9-10 inches of rain in a couple of hours. All of that, in our view, it provides a justification to a what we hope is a prudent trustee to do something about this that is that is along the lines of either what we proposed, is along the lines of what we proposed.
You know that there will be those, you know, we talked about those who will oppose it in the legislature and in the general public. if, you know, this would be implemented, cap and trade implemented here in Pennsylvania, there probably will be those who would go to court to stop it. You maybe just made that argument, but will the argument be in court if it does indeed go to court? Will it be come down to a yes-no question of whether the climate is changing and whether Pennsylvania has a role in it?
Well, my experience with litigation is that it's much, much, much more complicated than that, and it depends a whole lot on how legal issues are framed. I think, yes, could this wind up in litigation? Yes. But I think for us at least, the important thing is let's have this conversation about a specific proposal. And let's have that conversation now. I mean, the value, again, of what we're trying to do is to put a specific proposal in front of the Pennsylvania public so the Pennsylvania public and the Department of Environmental Protection and the governor and others can look at it and say, does this make sense? Is there another way to do this, perhaps? Well, maybe, okay, and if so, we'd be happy to take a look at that. But if you don't put a specific proposal out, then you can't have the conversation about costs and about science and about jobs and all of the rest. And actually, that's, I think, what we want to try and have. We want to try and have that conversation so that we can figure out the best way to move forward. Mm-hmm. We think this is a pretty good approach. The cap-and-trade approach is how we reduced nationally sulfur dioxide emissions from coal-fired power plants by 50% over a 10-year period between 1990 and 2000. This is something that we have lots of experience with. It's the cheapest way. It's probably the cheapest way to get this done. And it has all sorts of co-benefits in terms of stimulating the economy, creating jobs, creating a stable investment platform for decision makers and all the rest. I mean, the problem right now, if you're a utility, all right, and you're trying to look at the landscape ahead, and you have 8 years of Obama, now you've got Trump, and then you're thinking, well, the next Democrat is going to go back to what Obama did or something like it. That doesn't exactly provide a stable investment platform. And what we're trying to do is provide a stable investment platform for the next, 30-odd years as a way of providing sort of a way through this and a way through sort of the shifting winds of the politics.
We're almost out of time. Marie, you did talk with the Wolf administration in reporting this story. What was their response to it?
Well, actually, they just gave a very short emailed response, and they said that, you know, there is this legal process for a petition like this, so the Department of Environmental Protection, the Environmental Quality Board, will look at it. They said Governor Wolf does believe climate change is real and that the administration will continue to take steps to address it while trying to grow the economy.
But no definitive.
And, I didn't ask them whether he thought it was real. I know that he has said it's an issue he's interested in and cares about addressing. So maybe we'll see what happens in his second term here. Maybe there will be a bigger push by the administration to deal with this issue.
So, Professor Dernbach, quickly, what's the next step in this?
The next step, I think, is up to the department and the Environmental Quality Board respond to the petition.
Professor John Dernbach, Commonwealth Professor of Law and Sustainability at Widener University Commonwealth Law School, Marie Cusick, State Impact Pennsylvania reporter. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks.
Thank you, Scott.
State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among WITF, WHYY, WESA, and the Allegheny Front to report on Pennsylvania's energy economy. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. By the way, coming up, speaking of Governor Wolf, a week from Friday, Smart Talk will have a road trip to the governor's residence, and Governor Wolf will be on the program with us. In fact, if you would like to attend the live broadcast and possibly ask the governor a question, you could do that. We do ask that you RSVP, go to WITF.org/events. But I'm sure that this is one of the issues that we'll discuss with the governor is cap and trade and climate change. That's coming up next Friday, December 7th, at the governor's residence on 2nd Street in Harrisburg. If you'd like to attend, even if you just want to see the governor's residence and decorate it for the holidays, you could do that. But go to WITF.org and RSVP, WITF.org/events. In 2016, Penn Live published Failing the Frail, a six-part investigative series that explored major problems in Pennsylvania's nursing home industry, including the death of 46 residents. That investigation was prompted in part by a 2015 lawsuit filed by Pennsylvania's Attorney General against Golden Living and other nursing home chains in Pennsylvania. 3 years after the lawsuit and 2 years after the publication of Failing the Frail, Penn Live wanted to use Golden Living's nursing homes as a lens to reexamine the state of Pennsylvania's nursing home industry. We're going to talk about that series today with Ron Southwick, who is the managing producer of Still Failing the Frail Project at Penn Live. Mr. Southwick, welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Here, let me get the right microphone. There you go.
Okay.
If you have a question or comment, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org or on Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, I remember the original series 3 years ago. We had the reporter on the program talking about it. Why the need to update it, and what did you find in the 3 years since the original series?
Okay, well, we wanted to look at the nursing homes that were formerly managed by Golden Living. We wanted to take a fresh look. It was actually 3 years after the lawsuit that was filed by then Attorney General Kathleen Kane. And
who's going to jail tomorrow?
Exactly. Yeah. So, but she did something that really was kind of groundbreaking in filing this lawsuit against Golden Living, alleging poor care at these nursing homes. It really kickstarted a bunch of changes and at least promises for change at the state level to improve nursing home care around the state. So, 2 years after our initial series, Failing the Frail, we wanted to look back at how some of these homes that had been formerly managed by Golden Living, see if they'd gotten any better. We heard from some residents or some family members of residents that things were not to their liking. So we took a look at took an exhaustive look over the course of 8 months, looking at state inspection records, talking to various numbers of families, staffers, and also advocates for seniors. We basically found, at least looking at these homes that are formerly managed by Golden Living, that in most cases, care had not improved, and in some cases, it had gotten worse. Golden Living had managed 36 nursing homes in Pennsylvania. Our examination found that 22 of those 36 nursing homes had as many or more citations than they had under Golden Living. Staffing in most of those nursing homes also was the same or had gotten worse, looking at state records as well. And we've talked to a number of advocates and people who look at the nursing home industry said that's sort of a common theme that happens across the nursing home industry. A lot of homes that just are perpetually challenged often stay challenged, especially if they get sold from time to time. And there's a number of factors at play here. Some nursing home operators will say, and they have merit in saying this, that funding is not what it should be. Funding from federal and state governments.
Medicaid and Medicare.
Now, Medicare, run by the federal government, typically covers short-term care. Like, say, if somebody has a broken hip and they're maybe in a nursing home for a few weeks for rehabilitation purposes to get back on their feet a little bit, Medicare would sort of cover that. Now, for longer term, say, like maybe for months or an indefinite day, that would start typically be covered under Medicaid, and that's a program run by the states. And a lot of nursing home operators in Pennsylvania and advocates for seniors as well would say that Medicaid funding is not what it should be. So there are certain truths when nursing home operators say the funding is challenged for these facilities.
So staffing has always seemed to be an issue.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about in your investigation and from what the government says, what the industry says, of what is adequate staffing, and at some of these homes where it is not occurring, I know it goes by hours. It's kind of complicated to understand. Yeah. But can you explain that?
It gets a little complicated to explain sort of quickly and in sort of soundbite form. But yeah, there's a lot of advocates that talk about the level of care, and some talk about like number of hours per care per resident, so that each resident should get on average sort of about 4 hours direct care is what some advocates would say per day. Yes. So now that can vary depending on the sickness of the individual involved. If somebody needs more care or less care, some people. But they're saying on average residents should be getting 4 hours per day. Now it's worth noting that Pennsylvania's minimum requirements is not 4 hours. It's a little bit lower than that. And some advocates say that Pennsylvania needs to improve its staffing requirements, and that's something that advocates have said that Pennsylvania. That'd be one step Pennsylvania could do to improve the quality of care of nursing home residents is to, you know, boost the minimum staffing requirements.
How is that measured, though? I have to say, and I've mentioned this on the air before, my mother is a resident of a nursing home. And, you know, and I'm just picturing when a CNA or a nurse or a staff member is in, it's not 4 solid hours or 2 solid hours. It's, you know, lunchtime.
And we're talking about averages, of course, of a day. Because, I mean, sometimes they're in for, you know, maybe for intensive therapy. Sometimes they're there to change a dressing or to reposition a patient, depending if it's a resident that maybe is largely confined to the bed. And so they have to reposition them and avoid bed sores and stuff like that. So it's not 4 hours of a block of time, but it's over the course of a day that they're, you know, the advocates would say that 4 hours would be a better barometer for, you know, helping ensure the care of these residents.
All right, so staffing is an issue, but what does that lead to? What are some of the citations that you're talking about? What are some of the issues that we're dealing with here?
In our investigation, we found a number of different issues ranging quality of care to, cleanliness issues in some of the facilities. In some cases, residents that fell. There was one particular instance we found in a Cumberland County facility where there was a resident that had some issues and had assaulted another resident, and that the facility was actually cited by the state for not doing enough to A, make sure that this didn't happen, but then also didn't report it properly as well. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of supervisory issues that have related directly to quality of care. Again, a lot of these tend to relate to staffing. That's sort of the one thing we found at a lot of these nursing homes. I think when we looked at the series, and we looked again, and again, the series focused largely on the homes that were formerly run by Golden Living. So 36 of those 36 homes we looked at, about 31 of them, staffing was the same or had gotten worse over the period of 2 years.
Since the takeover. Who is the new company?
There's 4 companies that have actually took over the Golden Living homes. Priority Healthcare has taken taken ownership of 11 nursing home licenses of those 36, including several that are here in Pennsylvania, central Pennsylvania. Skyline Healthcare had acquired 7 of those licenses. That's a company that actually is an interesting case to talk about, because this is where advocates say the state needs to be doing a little bit better job vetting nursing home owners. Skyline was one of the companies that bought homes that were formerly run by Golden Living. About a year later, after the State Department of Health had given them approval to get those licenses, Skyline, citing a bunch of financial difficulties, basically abandoned its nursing homes, and Pennsylvania, along with other states, had to take emergency control of those facilities to make sure they were getting care, and then they had to move to find new owners for some of those nursing homes. So critics really looked at the Skyline case as an interesting example of, like, you know, where the state needs to be doing a little bit better job of vetting, because a year after getting licenses, they basically got out of the nursing home business. They were saying, well, if their finances were that precarious, at least according to some what advocates say, maybe the state should have been looking and doing a little better job to make sure they were up to the task of running nursing homes.
How many nursing homes are there in Pennsylvania?
I actually don't have the exact number, but there's 90,000 nursing home residents across the state.
Well, the reason I ask that question is because you were looking into the former Golden Living cases. Yeah. Is it fair to say then that the industry itself is having these kind of problems, or is it just this one group of homes that were owned by this one company?
Advocates would certainly say this is a challenge across the industry for a number of reasons. Nursing home operators would say with some merit that, you know, funding is an issue, because funding helps dictate the level of staffing that they can provide. If they get less funding than they would like from Medicaid, that does make it harder to to hire not just nurses, but like, you know, registered nurses and LPNs, and, you know, the nurses are really, you know, good quality nurses who have experience and can take care of people too. But advocates say that this is a problem that's really emblematic of the industry, and it's a problem that's going to get worse because, as we all know, America's got a growing senior population. You're going to be seeing more and more people probably heading to nursing homes. So this is something that there's no easy magic silver bullet solution, but it's something that, you know, policyholders, elected officials are going to have to address as the population gets older.
Someone we heard from this morning is Eric Keel, who is the Director of Communications and Public Affairs with the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association. Mr. Keel, are you there? Mr. Keel?
Yeah, hi, Scott.
Hi, how are you?
This is Russ McDade, the president and CEO of Pennsylvania Healthcare Association.
Oh, okay. All right. So we were contacted by your communications office, and you, first of all, tell us what the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association is, who you represent.
Yeah, first I want to thank you for having us on to provide another perspective on this. We represent roughly 300 nursing facilities statewide here in Pennsylvania, and there are currently 699 to answer the prior question. And what we do on their behalf is work here in and around both the state and federal governments to ensure that they have the tools that they need, both financial tools and human resources, as well as the regulatory climate that they need to ensure that they can do what their number one focus is, and that's provide the highest quality of resident care that they can each and every day to the folks in their nursing homes.
Now, do you represent for-profit or non-profit nursing homes?
We represent both. We primarily represent the privately held or investor-owned folks, but we do represent both for-profit and not-for-profit nursing homes. There really isn't a significant difference based on that status. The difference comes when you look at the level of Medicaid that they care for. And that's really kind of when you start to drill down in this. It's that Medicaid funding and the inadequacy of that Medicaid funding on covering the facility's cost on a daily basis that really we believe is one of the key roots to the challenges that everyone is seeing.
And we want
and the for-profit facilities have more than 70%, almost 75% of their average residents on Medicaid, where a not-for-profit would have just under 60. So, you know, that kind of gives you a sense, Scott.
All right. Well, you say there's not a big difference, and you're right when you talk about those percentages of patients that, you know, it's being funded by Medicaid. But the big difference is that a for-profit facility, that the goal is to make money there, to make a profit, as compared to a nonprofit. So I know that, you know, one of the things that was touched on in this series is that there were cutbacks in staffing, cutbacks in other areas, so that profits could be increased.
Yeah, well, first, I mean, I gotta, you know, share that, look, no business, whether you're a healthcare facility or a hardware store, stays in business if you're not earning a, quote, profit. So the belief that not-for-profits don't have to earn a positive margin is just inaccurate.
I'm
not in the
that.
Business of losing money.
Understand.
You know, everybody's got to earn a margin, you know, to stay open. And, you know, the finances of the sector are different on one side or the other. The challenge that they both face is that here in Pennsylvania, our state Medicaid program is paying them almost $50 a day less than their actual cost of care say they should be paid. And that math works out to $17,750, almost $18,000 a year per Medicaid resident. And you multiply that times a facility with 100 Medicaid residents, and that is a $1.8 million a year hit. And you can't make that up when you're losing that much money on your core line of business on volume, which means as a facility, you're forced, unfortunately, to put every dollar that you can at the resident bedside. You're forced to invest to the extent that you can in your staff. But there's only so far you can go with underfunding when you're so heavily dependent on Medicaid funding.
But the difference is, now, you know, I think, and I don't want to get into a philosophical discussion of for-profit, non-profit. You know, one of the differences here in your industry is that people's lives are at stake. People's health is at stake. And if you do have to make those cuts at the bedside, that staffing has to be cut, or maybe some other areas have to be reduced. People's lives are impacted by that. How do your members make that decision to make sure that those residents are still getting quality care, even though there may be some, there is a motivation to maximize profits, or at least to be profitable?
Yeah, and that's their number one priority, Scott. And you both touched on it a little earlier. We have a state staffing standard here in Pennsylvania in our regulations. It's 2.7 nursing hours per resident day. And the federal government is now looking at this themselves. And in the data, statewide Pennsylvania data from the first quarter of 2018, so that would have been earlier this year, that's the most recent data available, the Pennsylvania statewide average is 3.81 hours per nursing day, far exceeding that state minimum. You also noted, appropriately, by the way, Ron noted, that is dependent on the acuity of the individual. So lower acuity folks, if you've got a facility where people have less needs and don't have as many co-occurring healthcare needs or aren't as severely compromised, your staffing level would change versus a facility where they are. Now, our folks put every resource that they can towards their resident, and towards the resident care. One of the highest costs in healthcare and long-term care, it's hitting us straight between the eyes right now, is staff turnover. Because if it's difficult work, it's awful thankless work. And if you can't pay people the wage that, say, the Sheets or the Wawa down the street can, and they can go make $2 or $3 more an hour down there for work where, it's far less challenging, both emotionally and oftentimes physically, we just can't compete. So we're having a hard time holding on to our best and brightest. And it's high stress work. There's always going to be some turnover anyway, because this is for people who are truly compassionate and dedicated to caring for the seniors.
Hey, Mr. McDade, I'm glad that we had an opportunity to talk, and I'm going to make this. We've been talking with the organization in the past about getting someone on the program. And I'm saying right now, we need to do that and talk about this a little bit more. So I'm running out of time for this portion, but there's an invitation out there, and we will get in touch and schedule something, okay?
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you very much. But Ron Southwick, let me get back to, you heard what Russ McDade had to say. And by the way, this was not, this is Penn Live. By the way, you also can see this on papost.org, this series of stories, which are very well done, very well investigated. Not supposed to be one-sided. You did talk to the Pennsylvania Healthcare Association, a lot of other people involved in the industry. But your reaction to what he just had to say?
He raises, he makes very valid points. In terms of the Medicaid funding, most advocates for seniors and nursing home operators would agree that Medicaid funding is a serious challenge in terms of staffing.
Most? How about all?
I would tend to think yes. Yeah, I always try to qualify a little
bit. I try
to be careful as journalists.
You may get that 1% say, we're okay.
Yes, there's that 1%, yes. But yes, pretty much everybody agrees staffing is going to be a serious issue as long as Medicaid is funding is not really addressed, and that's something that policymakers are going to have to look at.
We only have 3 minutes left, and I do want to touch on this, and I will vow that we will talk more about this in a future program. The state's role in this. Mm-hmm. 3 years ago, one of the things that you investigated, Penn Live investigated, was whether there were inspections taking place as they were supposed to, when they were scheduled to. 3 years since, has there been any improvement in the state role?
I think advocates would say that's sort of mixed at best in terms of oversight, and I think that's going to be really interesting because the same day we published our series, a few hours later, the state auditor general, Eugene DePasquale, put out a statement and said he's going to begin another audit of the Department of Health's oversight of nursing homes and trying to look at their oversight and look at how the health department is looking to make sure that that nursing homes are doing their job. So I think what advocates, where the frustration comes with the Department of Health is in terms of the not so much even the amount of inspections, but when inspections find something that there's relatively few penalties. I think we found in the series of looking at the homes we examined, 100 citations that that were spotted by, say, 100 instances where inspections led to citations, about only 10 of those actually led to a penalty of some kind in terms of a financial penalty. So there are some people, advocates especially, who say the State Department of Health can be doing more to be a little bit tougher to coax homes into improving more.
Did the Auditor General do an audit on?
The Auditor General did an audit in 2016, and he highlighted some areas for improvement. And in the course of that, initially the Department of Health apparently, the Auditor General credited the Health Department for making some changes in terms of being more transparent in how it was overseeing nursing homes and inspections and such like that. What the Auditor General said just a couple of weeks ago, after we published our series, that he wants to take another look to see if the Health Department is continuing to make progress in its oversight. So,
Ron Southwick, obviously there is a lot to talk about here that we can't just cover in a half hour on the air. You have a six-part series. You could see it on PennLive.com. It's also on PAPost.org. Want to thank you very much for being with us today.
Yeah. Could I pimp something real quick just to help? Because I know your mom's been in a facility. Dad was in a facility. Look at PennLive.com for tips on how to find a good nursing
home. That's one of the things I wanted to ask about. Yes. And you have a database of all the homes in the state and
Absolutely.
How they're rated, correct?
Mm-hmm. Correct.
Okay. So, very valuable tool right there. You know, one of the things that we should talk about another time is how do you actually do it, because many people are thrown into the situation very quickly. Ron, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.